Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. Candace and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Breast Cancer. And we do this program actually on an annual basis, and we do it usually a few days before Metastatic Breast Cancer Awareness Day, which is actually on October 13th. So we're kind of reminding all of you that that day is coming up. And we also want to give acknowledgement during this month that many of you are living with metastatic breast cancer. We want to have a program that's particularly tailored for each of you. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration and your interest in our program today that we have over 855 participants on the program today. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, New Zealand, Syria, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's a bit of a global call, and you really are from all over the world to some extent on this call today. Now, today's activity was made possible by ISI Incorporated, Novartis Oncology, and supported by a grant from Genentech. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program, but also for their corporate partnership and collaboration in making this important program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. Really, we really just have just the best speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Generosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Medical Director, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Division Head, Hematology and Medical Oncology, the Cooper Health System, Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School at Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to present an overview of metastatic breast cancer and current standard of care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grana.
Carolyn, thank you for having me on the program. Metastatic disease is unfortunately something that we see relatively often in our practice. Most patients have had a previous diagnosis of breast cancer. Only about 10 to 20% of patients present as their newly diagnosed case with metastatic disease. So about 85% of them have been previously treated for breast cancer and fortunately have an oncology team that they can rely on and turn to for guidance through this process. Metastatic disease tends to present with signs of the disease or symptoms from their disease, a lymph node, a cough, abdominal pain, headache, symptoms that would guide workup. Up to date, no one has shown that doing serial scans or serial tumor markers for early stage disease is helpful at detecting metastatic disease early. So the majority of patients are not picked up with anything other than something as an incidental finding on a scan that was done for another reason or, again, with signs or symptoms of recurrence. Prognosis, once a diagnosis occurs, varies depending on how the patient is diagnosed. It varies by site of recurrence. Patients who recur in the skin or in the lymph nodes do very well. Bone, pleura do very well. Patients with lung or liver involvement, less well, but still have very many treatment options. And brain or meningeal disease do less well. So clearly, where a patient recurs is important in terms of prognosis and also in terms of treatment planning. Time from original diagnosis to recurrence is very important. The longer a woman took to develop a reoccurrence, the better her prognosis. So that's something we take into account. And lastly, the type of tumor that recurs is important. So whenever possible, if at all possible, we try to biopsy a patient who presents with signs and symptoms of recurrence so we can retest that tumor, and we test it for estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2-new receptor, and now we actually even have newer tools such as Foundation Medicine or Keras, what people call next-generation sequencing, that will give us access to a lot of the genetic alterations that have happened in that tumor that can help us in terms of selecting treatment or assessing whether a patient may be a candidate for a clinical trial. So again, when a patient has an abnormality, we try to make a diagnosis with a tissue diagnosis to look at each of these factors, and then a discussion has to ensue about appropriate treatment. current selection of therapy really also depends on the site of disease, and that determines the urgency with which we plan treatment. Clearly, someone who has bone only or lymph node only or skin only, indolent disease, no great urgency, whereas if someone has disease in the lung or liver or other, the urgency increases. There's always emotional urgency, and we always take that into account as well. But in terms of the approach, varies by presentation. The selection of therapy also depends on what the patient had previously as therapy. If they had Adriamycin, we tend not to go back to it. If they had taxanes and they have some early recurrence, we may not go back to that. We also look at pre-existing toxicity from their prior therapy, neuropathy, cardiomyopathy, other toxicity. Those are the kinds of things that we take into consideration when selecting our approach. Again, the estrogen, progesterone, and HER2-new status are very important in telling us whether we should go with hormonal therapy, whether we should go with HER2-new-based therapy. We also take into account patients' wishes and patients' lifestyle. Some people who are trying to work diligently prefer getting treated every 3 weeks with chemotherapy versus weekly. Some people would prefer oral versus intravenously. Some people are very focused on not having hair loss. So clearly, as we look to pick a therapy for a particular patient, we not only look at disease site, prior therapy, pre-existing toxicity, features of the cancer, patient wishes, but now, again, we're looking at some of these newer approaches with personalized medicine, gene sequencing to guide us in clinical trials and treatment modalities. Approach to treating a patient, it depends on the type of cancer. So if a cancer is estrogen or progesterone receptor positive and there is no life-threatening disease, the approach is hormonal, and many options exist for hormonal therapy. They also depend in terms of the woman's menopausal status. So if a woman is premenopausal, we might do ovarian suppression plus a hormonal agent. If she's postmenopausal, our choices differ. If a woman is estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, chemotherapy is her best approach, and then we have a wide discussion about the drugs available, their toxicity, the appropriate choices. And fortunately, if a woman is HER2-new positive, we have some very exciting new drugs that really have made a dramatic difference in that population of patients. The important thing, and I don't have time to get into any detail about the specifics, and others will be talking about recent clinical trials, the important thing to communicate to a woman who's newly diagnosed with metastatic disease is that prognosis has improved very dramatically, that new treatments have come along. In the last 2 years alone, we've had significant improvements with combinations of drugs that add to the benefit of hormonal therapy, combinations of drugs that add to the benefit of HER2-new targeted therapy. So I think it's a new era in the treatment of breast cancer, and this will continue to improve as new drugs come on the horizon and new combinations are studied. So I think this is a very promising time for women dealing with metastatic disease. And I'll stop there.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Guano. That was a wonderful setting the stage for the entire call today and giving so much information. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruth Oretz. Dr. Oretz is Clinical Professor of Medicine, Firm Chief, Department of Medicine, NYU Langone Medical Center, Laura and Isaac Perlmutter Cancer Center. And Dr. Oretz is going to address diagnostic testing and technologies and new treatment approaches. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Oretz.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it's really my pleasure to be with everyone today. So as we heard, the clinical presentation of metastatic breast cancer is very important in determining treatment options and next steps. There are many different ways that metastatic breast cancer can present, sometimes with a clinical sign or symptom. Patients might feel a new mass or a lump. There could be changes in the skin or other symptoms like cough or shortness of breath, abdominal discomfort, bloating, or pain. So we need to evaluate patients who present with the suspicious findings of metastatic disease with our diagnostic tests. Very often we'll begin with, of course, a physical examination, which should be a complete and careful physical exam. blood work, which can give us an indication about liver function tests, how the bones are doing, blood counts. And sometimes in this setting, although we don't recommend using tumor markers for predicting early recurrence or metastatic disease, but sometimes tumor markers can be helpful in establishing whether or not there is metastatic disease present, and also for following patients once treatment has started. But really, we turn to radiographic imaging next in confirming a diagnosis, and there are many, many different types of imaging tests that we use, simple x-rays, CAT scans, sometimes a PET or PET scan can be done, nuclear bone scans, ultrasound, MRI, a whole array of imaging tests, which gives us a picture of what's really going on inside the body. And as Dr. Grana said, once we can identify where it looks like the recurrence is, in which part of the body, in which tissue, then it really is very important, if at all possible, to go ahead and biopsy that tissue to confirm the diagnosis and, as she said, to look at that molecular profile, which is very much going to help us decide on the type of treatment. The techniques that we use for biopsying are also very variable depending on what type of tissue we're sampling and the anatomic location in the body. If a tumor is easily accessible under the surface of the skin or in an area that the radiologist can see very easily on a CAT scan or an ultrasound, we may just use a fine needle or core needle biopsy. This is very often done with imaging guidance so that the radiologist who's doing the test or the physician who's doing that biopsy knows exactly where to place the needle to get a good sample of the tissue so it can be analyzed. Sometimes patients present with fluid that's accumulating, fluid around the lung or in the abdomen, or if we think the fluid in the spinal canal is abnormal, that fluid can be analyzed also usually by putting a needle into the space that we are interested in, withdrawing some of that fluid and sending it to the laboratory. So based on our diagnostic tests and technologies, we then can turn to the treatment approaches. You're going to hear in a few minutes about clinical trials and some of the experimental approaches that we're using based on deep genomic analysis of the tumor, but I thought I would mention some of the new treatments that have been developed for metastatic breast cancer in the most recent years. For hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, ER and PR-positive, of course, we have multiple agents that target that estrogen receptor pathway, and you've heard of these, tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, fazlodexel, fulvestrant, and others, and of course for HER2-positive disease. But there are a number of new targeted biologic agents which have already been approved for treatment, and there are two in particular which have been shown that when they're combined together with standard hormonal therapies can result in better outcomes. One of these drugs is everolimus, also called Afinitor. This is an oral medicine. It's a pill that can be given in addition to either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, and it has shown improvement in results over using one of those agents alone. We have to be mindful about making sure we select patients carefully for these drugs because they do have a different package of side effects. Everolimus is known to cause mouth sores, sometimes diarrhea. Patients can develop cough or sometimes other problems with their lungs that can mimic pneumonia while they're on this medicine. So we have to be careful about the dosage and the schedule, and it's very, very important on these medications to be in good communication with your care team about how you're feeling and your side effects. We have learned lots of tricks about how to give the drugs safely and effectively. Another one of these new targeted drugs that has now been approved for commercial use is called palbociclib, or Ibrance, and this is also an oral drug, a pill. It's given in general in combination either with fulvestrant, that's Faslodex, or an aromatase inhibitor. And this drug also has been shown to enhance the activity of hormonal therapies. The main side effects from this drug are a decrease in the blood counts, particularly the white blood cell count, also some anemia and fatigue. So it's important on this medicine that your team watches blood counts very carefully and, again, monitors how you're feeling. As Dr. Grana mentioned, for HER2-new positive disease, we have a number of new agents which now have been approved and we've been using in the past year or so, even a little bit longer. You may have heard of Kadcyla or T-DM1, which is a drug that's a conjugate. That is that the drug itself is trastuzumab, Herceptin, which is combined in one molecule with a chemotherapy drug. And this has been shown to target those HER2-positive cells, delivering the chemotherapy medicine only to the cells that are HER2-positive. So we see very good clinical results in many patients, and it's well tolerated without very serious side effects. Pertuzumab, or Perjeta, is a monoclonal antibody, very similar in its structure to Herceptin, but which targets a slightly different receptor in the HER2 family and has been shown when used in combination with Herceptin and chemotherapy to give us some very, very good results in patients. There are a number of oral HER2-targeted drugs, in particular lapatinib or Tykerb, which we use, and a newer agent, neratinib, which is still in clinical trial but looks very promising in this setting of HER2-positive disease. For patients who have triple-negative breast cancer, that is where the ER, PR, and HER2-new are negative, we do still rely largely on chemotherapy as our mainstay of treatment. There's a lot of research in this area. In particular, we're looking at the use of adding the platinum drugs, which are, of course, commercially available, and a number of immunotherapy trials which are underway. Finally, for patients who have BRCA mutations, we have access to some of the PARP inhibitors, which are drugs, biologically targeted drugs, which we think are particularly active in tumors in patients who have BRCA mutations. Also, the platinum agents may be more helpful in this setting. So in treating metastatic breast cancer, we have many, many options. This depends on the diagnosis, and we rely on our testing and diagnostic technologies to help us determine the location of the metastatic disease and the type of metastatic disease, and then based on that, to look at our various treatment approaches, including some of these new agents.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Oritz. That was excellent and lots of excellent information that I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Shavita Vinayak. Dr. Vinayak is assistant professor, University Hospitals Case Medical Center, Becky Hennessy Endowed Master Clinician in Breast Cancer Genomics, and Dr. Vinayak is going to address clinical trials, how clinical research improves your care, and breast cancer genomics and precision medicine. Dr. Vinayak?
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to all of you on the call today. I'm going to talk about clinical trials and really the importance of these clinical trials. As you heard from our previous speakers, clinical trials are hugely important in making advances in really all cancers in the medical field in general. And obviously, you know, several hundreds and thousands of patients have participated previously in clinical trials, and that's how we've made, you know, a huge amount of progress in treating our breast cancer patients. There are, I think, several misconceptions about clinical trials. People typically don't want to participate in clinical trials because they have certain concerns, which are reasonable. And I think as a team, the medical team, we need to come together and address those concerns. So there are definitely, you know, fears of the cost related to the clinical trials outside of standard treatments and what that would entail. Many patients are concerned about side effects of the treatments themselves, since these are newer agents, and patients are concerned, you know, how these side effects would be different from approved medications in breast cancer. And I know several patients may be concerned about whether they would be getting, you know, an ineffective medication or possibly a placebo for treatment of their cancer, and I will address some of these down the road. You know, clinical trials are hugely important because that is really how we can bring promising new drugs and, you know, test these drugs and make progress against, you know, treating breast cancer. So as, you know, in the oncology field, we have benefited tremendously from hundreds and thousands of patients participating so far. And this is really how the investigators, you know, design studies and the way physicians bring these drugs to the patients. And until, you know, they're proven and tested, they don't make it out to the market. So one thing I want to bring up is that even, you know, which is true at our institution and I think, you know, nationally and internationally, that really only a few patients who are actually eligible for clinical trials go on the studies. And I think this is where we could really make a huge impact. The fewer the patients that go on certain clinical trials, really the longer it takes for new promising medications, potentially really good treatments to be approved because the trials just take so much longer to complete. And that means, you know, there are, you know, many patients who may not benefit from these treatments in a more timely fashion. There are, you know, the concern about placebos exists in clinical trials. And according to, you know, the National Cancer Institute and just those of us in terms of investigators who do clinical trials, placebos are almost never used in cancer treatment trials. The designs of these trials go through a very stringent process within our own institutions and nationally. And it is most of the trials, the way they're designed, they test, you know, standard treatments against the newer agents or maybe addition of certain new drugs to the standard treatments. There are many phases of clinical trials. When you look on the websites such as clinicaltrials.gov or through the National Cancer Institute, other websites as well, probably, you know, through the cancer centers that you're getting treated at, most of the clinical trial information is on those sites as well. So there's many phases of these trials, and it really just depends on sort of where the drug is in the spectrum in terms of, you know, how far it's come along. So in terms of phase one studies, those tend to be sort of our earliest clinical trials where the side effects of these drugs is really being looked at. And in some, you know, sort of larger phase one studies, they start to look at a signal or a hint of how this treatment may be benefiting the patients. In what's called phase two clinical trials, this is where we really start to look at how the treatment may be working and if it's benefiting our patients, you know, if it's a new drug, how is it different from what we've looked at before in terms of chemotherapy or other targeted therapies. And phase three are really much larger, what we call randomized trials, where the standard treatment or a different treatment may be compared head-to-head with the new treatment, and, you know, half of the patients may go on one arm and half of the patients may go on a different arm, and we look at, you know, are the patients doing better on this medication, you know, the newer drug, or are the patients living longer, how are the side effects, you know, when these larger studies are done, and that's how typically the drugs make it to the market. So it takes really many, many years of work on, you know, of course, on the side of the institutions, investigators, but the clinical trials wouldn't really go anywhere or make any progress if, you know, we didn't have the patients participating in them. And so it's really done in partnership, and we all sort of make the progress in cancer together. In terms of targeted therapies or precision medicine, as you've heard previously, there is really a lot of work being done in this setting, and I think this is great for metastatic breast cancer. It is, you know, I'm very optimistic about some of the work that's being done currently. Cancer is really a problem of, you know, uncontrolled growth of cells, and this can happen due to many changes that occur in a cell, really at a molecular level. And what precision medicine or targeted therapy, you know, what that really means is it's trying to match the so-called drivers of the cancer and finding medications that can put the brakes on these drivers. So it's really trying to match the changes that are happening in the tumor at a molecular level and finding the drugs that would work to control those changes. In terms of breast cancer, I think we're very fortunate that we've really been doing what, you know, what I would think is classified as targeted therapy for a very long time, because we use the markers in the tumors such as estrogen receptor or ER, progesterone receptor PR or the HER2 marker to make treatment decisions. And we've been doing this for a long time, as you heard, you know, in terms of doing hormone blocking medications, combining with newer drugs and the HER2 targeted treatments such as Kadcyla, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. All of those are, you know, targeted therapies for metastatic breast cancer, and of course are being, you know, some of them are being used in early stage breast cancer as well right now. I want to highlight, you know, I think a really important trial that is, you know, has taken this precision medicine initiative across nationally, and it's called the NCI MATCH study. This is from the National Cancer Institute, and this is a national study, and based on my most recent look at clinicaltrials.gov, it's available at 690 locations across the country, and it's again asking the same question in advanced cancer, and metastatic breast cancer patients are of course included, is how can we, you know, use treatments that are directed at patients' tumors, so really looking at those precise changes and see how well these work in controlling the tumor. And then of course, you know, they're trying to also assess if, you know, if these really precise treatments make the patients live longer as well. In terms of, you know, some other targeted therapies, there is a lot of work done being done in triple-negative breast cancer, and that is, you know, one subtype of cancer where the estrogen marker is negative, the progesterone marker is negative, and the HER2 marker is negative. So it really comes down to, you know, currently we're using chemotherapy, but based on some really, you know, precise tools where we're looking at the biology of the triple negative breast cancer and trying to understand, you know, is there a lot of, you know, little subtypes of triple negative breast cancer, and a lot of progress has been made regarding that. There has been one particular subtype of triple negative breast cancer that is driven by androgen receptor, and in at least metastatic setting, there have been a few trials done in that particular subtype where patients have responded to those treatments. So it gives patients an option for an oral medication, you know, that works in a particular subtype of triple negative breast cancer that's well tolerated. So it, I think that's, you know, huge progress, because those patients likely don't benefit as much or maybe less from chemotherapy. In terms of other clinical trial updates, specifically, we definitely have, you know, triple negative breast cancer. The platinum drugs are being looked at. in a metastatic setting, you know, specifically using them early on. There are certain drugs, such as PARP inhibitors, where we take advantage of the DNA repair defects that exist in the triple-negative tumors, and those trials are ongoing. And what we're learning is that may be particularly effective for BRCA mutation carriers, so genetic testing becomes important for patients in this setting, and there's large trials, you know, sort of underway. And I think, you know, importantly, which is my, you know, last sort of clinical trial update, are that the immunotherapy trials are looking very promising, specifically in the triple-negative breast cancer subtype. So what they're looking at is, you know, the tumors put up a defense against the immune cell's ability to destroy the tumor, but these newer drugs, such as the PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies, and several new drugs are being developed in this arena. These drugs really just allow us to release the brakes on the on this defense system, and then allows the immune cells to destroy the tumor, which is really what we're looking from, you know, from these treatments. So as, you know, sort of a summary, I think, you know, participation in clinical trials is hugely important, and we wouldn't be able to make the progress that we've made today without clinical trial participation from, you know, our patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vignac. Very excellent and very comprehensive. And our next speaker is Dr. Aditya Bardia. Dr. Bardia is attending physician, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, assistant professor, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Bardia is going to address communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bardia.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello, everyone. I will be talking about communicating your healthcare team about quality of life concerns and management of treatment-related side effects. Maintaining quality of life is a very important goal in management of metastatic breast cancer, and it's very important to have a good communication with your healthcare team. For someone who has metastatic breast cancer, it is very likely that you have multiple providers. It could be a primary oncologist, it could be a palliative medicine physician, a nurse practitioner, a social worker. Sometimes you have a physician that you're seeing specifically for a clinical trial. It is very important that you have an effective communication with the various providers. It's okay to ask who is doing what and what their roles are. I would like to talk about three specific symptoms and the key issues related to management of these symptoms, as well as points to take home. The first symptom I would like to talk about is cancer-related pain. Cancer-related pain is the most common and one of the most distressing and feared symptoms among cancer patients. Due to its importance, cancer pain is often referred to as the fifth vital sign for oncology patients. Cancer pain varies both by the type of malignancy as well as the site of cancer involvement. So I would emphasize that it is very helpful and important to know the site and the source of pain. The cancer pain could be due to a direct effect of cancer as a result of tumor involvement, bone metastases, or infiltration of the nerve or nerve plexus. This is important to know because the management can be different. Cancer pain could also be because of side effects from chemotherapy, such as neuropathy that can come from chemotherapy agents. So based on the specific etiology in general, cancer-related pain can be divided into three major categories: pain that is musculoskeletal, pain that is visceral or deep, or pain that is neuropathic. In general, pain that is musculoskeletal is like an injury to the skin or to the bones that can cause a constant tenderness-like pain. In cancer patients, bone metastases would be an example of that. A second category would be the visceral pain, which is more like a dull, colicky pain that is often associated with dull nausea. And the third type of pain is the neuropathic pain, which is more like a prolonged, severe burning type of pain. And this is the kind of pain that is usually very resistant to pain medications, such as opioids, such as morphine, such as oxycodone, and often is the most challenging one to treat. So in order to help the oncologist or the treating physician understand the source of pain, it's very important that when you discuss your pain with your oncologist, you talk about five things. The first one is, when did the pain start, or the timing of the onset of the pain? The second is the specific site of the pain. Is it in the lower back, or is it more in the front? Is it a chest pain? What is the specific site of pain? And often, particularly when it's a visceral pain, it's very difficult to pinpoint one specific site. It's more diffuse, and that is fine. That does help in identifying the source of the pain, which can influence the management. The third thing to talk about is the severity of pain. Is it a pain that is 2 or 3 out of 10 but is present all the time? Or is it a pain that when it comes up, it's 8 or 9 in severity, it lasts for a few minutes and then it goes down? This is very important because it provides understanding about the cause of the pain and can influence the management. The fourth point would be the character of the pain. Is it a constant dull pain, or is it a sharp shooting kind of pain, more like a nerve pain, more like an electric shock? As I mentioned earlier, if the pain is because of neuropathy or related to the nerves, in general, the regular pain medications do not work that well. Often we have to consider specific medications that can affect the pain from nerves, such as gabapentin or Lyrica. These are medications that are often used in patients with diabetes who have pain secondary to neuropathy. And the fifth and the final thing I would say related to cancer-related pain is that you should let your physician know about things that make the pain matter and things that can make it worse. All of these things can be very helpful in understanding the cause of the pain, as well as in choosing the strategy that would work best for the specific type of pain that you have. The second symptom I would like to talk about is chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting, or nausea vomiting in general among patients with cancer. Nausea and vomiting is the most common adverse effect associated with chemotherapy and is very and can be very unpleasant and distressing side effect associated with therapy. It has multiple consequences, including dehydration, weight loss, electrolyte abnormalities, all of which can lead to profound weakness and can impair the quality of life. Currently, the mainstay for management of nausea vomiting that occurs because of chemotherapy is prevention. So there are multiple medications one can use to prevent nausea and vomiting that can come from chemotherapy, and often prevention is the best strategy for management of nausea and vomiting secondary to chemotherapy. The three major medications include Compazine, Zofran, and steroids. These medications are usually very helpful in preventing nausea and vomiting that occurs from chemotherapy. A second cause of nausea besides chemotherapy could be actually due to cancer. The cancer can cause nausea by physical obstructions, such as obstruction of the stomach due to cancer, or by causing metastases to the liver, which can then cause this general sense of nausea. The underlying principles remain the same. The medications such as Zofran, Compazine can help. If there is liver dysfunction, then the medications need to be titrated accordingly. A third cause of nausea vomiting that is seen in patients who have cancer is what is called anticipatory nausea. Just the thought of coming to the hospital, or even before you've received treatment, just when you're in the hospital building, you have this sense of nausea and this feeling of distress. For anticipatory nausea, the medication that usually works best is lorazepam or Ativan. That is something that can help with this type of nausea. Sometimes, despite all these medications, a patient can experience refractory nausea. In that setting, combination of medications can help. Benadryl is a medication that sometimes works well for refractory nausea. Another important issue to consider is to clarify whether the symptoms are truly because of nausea, or is it because of acid reflux, or because of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And if that is the case, medications that reduce acids such as omeprazole can help. In my personal experience, often it's very difficult to distinguish what is a dull nausea versus something that is actually coming because of acid. So if the nausea is refractory to the various anti-nausea medications, trying an over-the-counter anti-acid medication can often be helpful. And finally, it's important to consider the effect of other medications such as pain medications on nausea. Pain medications decrease the ability of the intestines to contract and thus can slow the intestinal motility, which indirectly can cause nausea. So it's also very important to consider the pain medications you're taking in, whether that is contributing to nausea. The third symptom I would talk about is fatigue, which is another common distressing symptom among patients with cancer. As with any symptom, trying to understand the cause of fatigue is important. It could be because of the disease in general, or it could be a side effect of treatment. Sometimes it could be because of other causes, such as depression or lack of sleep. And understanding the cause of fatigue can help with management. If it's because of depression or lack of sleep, management of those symptoms can actually improve fatigue. If it's because of treatment side effects such as low red blood cells because of chemotherapy, then a red blood cell transfusion can help with fatigue. Often fatigue is multifactorial, and that is why trying to understand the various pieces becomes important so they can be treated or targeted accordingly. There are medications that are used to treat fatigue, such as Ritalin, Provigil. I think they are reasonable options to consider in the short term, particularly if the cause of fatigue is because of the disease. But these medications need to be used very carefully. They have their own adverse effects. I would also emphasize the importance of other techniques, such as mind-body therapies, such as mindfulness-based approaches, meditation, yoga, which can sometimes help with fatigue. They usually take a while to work, but can be helpful in this setting, particularly when the cause of fatigue is multifactorial and related to mood-related symptoms as well. On these lines, there was a clinical trial published a couple of years ago which demonstrated that a dietary supplement called American ginseng or Wisconsin ginseng at 2,000 milligram twice a day in a randomized controlled clinical trial was found to be effective in treating cancer-related fatigue. So it's something that could be considered by patients. Finally, it's a bit counterintuitive, but multiple studies have shown that light exercise can actually combat fatigue. So that should also be considered in management of fatigue. Finally, I would say that the most important thing is effective and open communication with your oncology team. That is key to successful management of these symptoms. There are actually now specific clinics that can manage symptoms related to cancer, and you should consider referral to those clinics if you feel that your symptoms are not well controlled.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Vardy. That was excellent and really a lot of important information for everybody on the call, so thank you very much. And our next speaker is Ms. Allison Nielsen. Ms. Nielsen is an oncology social worker, and she's our Women's Cancers Program Director at Cancer Care, and she will address the free psychosocial services that are accessible from Cancer Care as well as the role of support groups. Ms. Nielsen?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As an oncology social worker, I work with many people coping with metastatic breast cancer and their loved ones. I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services to anyone affected by any type of cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York City area and also over the telephone nationally, support groups, face-to-face in New York City area and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in the ways in which cancer impacts a person and his or her family and friends. They are experienced in helping cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you probably know, metastatic breast cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. It can often be confusing and overwhelming. And October can be an especially emotionally complicated time for people with metastatic breast cancer when faced with a sea of pink ribbons and stories of quote-unquote beating cancer. The good news is that you do not have to walk this path alone. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about cancer. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice concerns and process your emotions. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience, and feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. We recognize that metastatic breast cancer presents its own distinct needs and challenges that are different from those of early-stage breast cancer. Cancer Care is proud to be a member of the Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance, an advocate-led alliance working together to transform and improve the lives of people living with metastatic breast cancer. The goals of the alliance are increasing awareness and education about the disease, and advancing policy and research specifically focused on metastasis that has the potential to extend life, enhance quality of life, and ultimately to cure. Cancer Care also has individualized support services available. We offer a support group over the telephone for people with metastatic breast cancer. There are also online groups available for metastatic breast cancer and triple negative breast cancer. And people with cancer in the New York tri-state area can attend our face-to-face in-person support groups. We offer dedicated face-to-face groups for young adults with cancer ages 18 to 39 and women who speak Spanish. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE, that's 1-800-813-4673, to speak with one of our oncology social workers. You may also wish to visit us online at www.cancercare.org, where you can register for online groups. And our comprehensive website is a place to find a lot of additional information on your diagnosis and the treatment you may receive. As we have learned a lot from today's metastatic breast cancer program, you might need some guidance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Cancer Care Services are here to help you through, and you are not alone. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Nielsen. And Allison, that was wonderful. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace if she would explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I'll give you numbers to call so that we can be sure to answer your questions before the call ends. So, Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. To those of you on the web, you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you, Sarah, so much. This is an excellent seminar, excellent. I'd like to find out about peripheral neuropathy. I've been taking alpha lipoic acid, B6, B12, and I wanted to know that from having had Taxol, it causes that. And also I wanted to know about the acupuncture for peripheral neuropathy and vitamin D for pain management that they're using. My doctor increased me to 2,000. He said he can go higher.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Okay. Stephanie, thank you. Excellent questions. Dr. Bardia, would you like to start by addressing those questions in general?
Absolutely. cancer-related neuropathy, unfortunately, is a very difficult symptom to treat. There have been multiple trials looking at multiple agents, including the lipoic acid as well as vitamin E, various medications. None have really borne fruit in multiple randomized clinical trials. Having said that, anecdotally, I've seen patients benefit from these agents. So I think the key is to try one agent and see if that controls the symptom. If it doesn't, then trying a different medication could help, particularly medications that are used for diabetes-related neuropathy or painful neuropathy like duloxetine. Those are medications that could potentially help if there's a lot of pain that is coming secondary to the neuropathy. Now, as far as acupuncture is concerned, the evidence is mixed. There are some studies which have shown that acupuncture can rewire the nerves, if you will, and can potentially help in the management of neuropathy, help in management of other cancer-related symptoms as well, including fatigue. However, there are studies which have shown that when you compare acupuncture to sham acupuncture, where the needles are put not in the acupuncture site but near the acupuncture site, the differences are minimal. So whether it's a real treatment effect versus a component of placebo effect is unclear, but if there's a patient who has a lot of symptoms, I would not oppose the use of acupuncture, particularly if the patient is not getting chemotherapy. The only time I'm concerned about acupuncture is when someone is getting active chemotherapy, because during active chemotherapy, the white blood cell counts can be low and the patient could be at increased risk of infection. And at that time, use of a needle could potentially have adverse effects. But outside of that, I would not be opposed and actually would be a bit in favor of trying other medications like acupressure or acupuncture to see if that would help with neuropathy. Now, finally, related to vitamin D, I'm not aware of a whole lot of literature supporting use of vitamin D for pain per se. I think in general it's a good idea to have the vitamin D level checked, particularly in the northern part of America where the exposure to sunlight is not great. I'm in Boston, so I can definitely tell about a number of patients who have low vitamin D secondary to just poor exposure to sunlight and the prolonged winter months we have. So it would be very reasonable to check vitamin D, and if the vitamin D levels are low, then supplementation with vitamin D would be very reasonable.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Anyone else want to add to that? Any other comments from any of the other speakers just before we? Okay. We have one of our online participants has a question asking that since many metastatic breast cancer patients have been previously diagnosed with earlier stage disease, how are we educating patients to the signs of metastatic disease so that they are aware of them, of when to seek medical evaluation? Is that a question that Dr. Grana, could you address that question? Is there any?
Sure. I think it's actually a very important part of the management of early stage breast cancer and whether a woman needs no chemotherapy and will just go on hormonal therapy, whether a woman needs no therapy at all and is just in observation, or whether a woman gets chemotherapy or Herceptin-based therapy. One of the elements that's being pushed across the country is the concept of giving women an end-of-treatment care plan, which is basically a review of her treatment to date that includes information about what's been done surgically, what's been done with radiation, with drug therapy, but also includes signs and symptoms to monitor for, what to report, what to look out for, and it communicates that information to the woman and to her primary care team, which I think is also very important because in addition to the woman being educated about the things she should be on the lookout for, her primary care team also needs to be educated about those same things. So across the country, many cancer centers are putting those systems in place and are using nurse practitioners, practice nurses, or other personnel along with the physicians to educate the patient about those things in addition to a management of toxicities of their treatment. So what should the woman be doing long term to address neuropathy or to address other issues, hot flashes, night sweats, or other things? So again, the education of the woman with early stage breast cancer around these topics is very important.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question? Thank you.
And our next question comes from Lynn F. Your line is now open.
Thank you so much. I realize that you are not proponents of using tumor markers prior to metastases, but you indicated that sometimes you do use them to track the effectiveness of medications or the progression of the disease. Have you noticed any patterns suggesting that the CA2729 is more effective for certain areas of metastases versus the CEA? It seems the women that I know that have liver mets have much more positive results using the CEA than the 2729. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Lynn, for being on the call. Good to hear your voice. And Dr. Orth, could you address this in a general way just to help the audience?
Yeah, of course. Yes, you're absolutely right that the standard guideline recommendations are not to use tumor markers to track patients after completing adjuvant therapy. Once a patient is diagnosed with metastatic disease, we can look at a panel of markers and see which ones are, if any, elevated, and then sometimes they can be helpful to follow response to treatment, although they're not perfect. You know, I can't really say that there's data that tells us that one particular marker is better than another for any particular site of disease, except that in the case of abdominal disease, where there's abdominal carcinomatosis or fluid in the belly and implants in the abdomen, sometimes using the CA125, which is thought of as being an ovarian cancer marker but really can also be elevated with any process going on in the abdomen, can be helpful. Of course, there is CA2729, CEA, and also CA15-3, which are used in breast cancer. I can't tell you that we really see a pattern, but that, you know, it's something for each patient to discuss with her own oncologist as to whether or not looking for a marker would be another helpful tool.
Excellent. Thank you. And this is a personal question, if we could take it and just generalize it, but the question is, after a unilateral mastectomy and stable metastatic ER-positive disease, how often should one have a mammogram of the opposite breast? It has been annual since diagnosis in 2011 and now recommend biannual with an annual ultrasound scan. And so the person's asking for just our perspective on that. And Dr. Grana, could you just address this again in a general way for the whole audience?
When a woman is diagnosed with metastatic disease, the priorities change. And I think this is a difficult discussion to have with patients, but the priorities really change to management of the metastatic disease rather than management of a small new cancer that could happen in the breast. So I actually urge women to not even focus on mammography until we get things very well controlled systemically. I do come back, though, to a woman who's got very stable metastatic disease, now multiple years, 2-3 years stable with metastatic disease, and that's a woman that I think is reasonable to go back to doing mammography, but never more than once a year because, again, we have metastatic disease elsewhere, so to think that we're going to make a difference in her outcome by finding a very small cancer in the breast doesn't make a lot of inherent sense. So, again, a change in focus and prioritization. And others may feel differently.
And could you just distinguish between recurrent disease versus metastatic disease? Because I think sometimes...
I think that's very different. So there are women who have local recurrences in the breast, and those are managed very differently. If a woman had a lumpectomy and she has a local reoccurrence in the breast, often that's treated with a mastectomy. And some of those women will get chemotherapy. Some of them will get hormonal therapy, different hormonal therapy or other. But again, those women are still cancer-free. That's a very different group of patients from those that have metastatic disease to a more distant organ, internal mediastinal nodes, liver, lung, pleura, bone. It's a very different prognosis and a different management.
Thank you. I'm going to take one late-breaking question here before we conclude. We're going to wrap up just shortly, but this last question is important. The question is about having multiple diagnoses in addition to cancer or other diagnoses and other health problems, and then in terms of watching all of their medications and potential side effects. And so, and the collaboration amongst all the different physicians. And Dr. Bardi, if you could just address this briefly to give some guidance to everybody on the call who may have some other health problems in addition to their metastatic breast cancer.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. More and more as metastatic disease is brought under control with therapies, looking at life outside of metastatic breast cancer and looking at other symptoms is important. As was mentioned earlier, if someone has stable metastatic disease for a couple of years, then focusing on mammogram is a reasonable thing to do. Often, other conditions such as heart disease or diabetes can play into this, and management of those conditions is very important as well. So I would emphasize that while metastatic breast cancer is definitely the center stage, it's important to evaluate the other health conditions as well, and it's important to keep the line open with your primary care physician.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been exceptional. I also want to thank all of you who've asked such really excellent questions. Now, I recognize that this is a one-hour call, of course, and that many of you have questions that have not yet been answered. So I do want to kind of, first of all, give you solutions to that issue. For any medical questions that you did not get answered on the call today, any questions about your medical care, please do call the National Cancer Institute. Their information specialists are on call waiting for your calls at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And for any of you who have questions about really accessing services from cancer care, those free services, either financial assistance or practical help or counseling or support groups or more information about workshops or our publications, please contact our 800 number at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. Also, we do have a program coming up on October 28th on update on triple-negative breast cancer for those of you on the call who might be interested in that particular program as well, and you'll be getting more information about that as well. Now, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with breast cancer and coping with metastatic breast cancer. And I want you to know that you're now part of this cancer care world here, and you can contact us at any time, and our staff are here, our oncology social workers are here to help you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.